Hello, and welcome to this podcast focusing on decoding the diagnosis of malignant pleural mesothelioma. In this episode, which includes excerpts from a recent virtual program, Drs. Akash Desai, Ivi Dugogojack, and Patrick Ford will discuss how to clinch the diagnosis and optimize treatment for patients with mesothelioma. This activity is provided by PER and supported by an educational grant from AstraZeneca. In the first segment, Dr. Desai discusses some diagnostic features of mesothelioma that can be seen on imaging and cytology.
So talking about imaging clues and pitfalls, so on CT chest, usually with pleural mesothelioma, we can see nodular pleural thickening, fissural involvement. Usually we do not see a parenchymal mass. We can see hypermetabolic internal mammary node, and then PET, FDG avid right pleural thickening and nodularity with mild mediastinal nodes. So let's first talk about why cytology fails in mesothelioma. We talked about, you know, the thoracentesis, which was sent for cytology, which was typically non-diagnostic in this particular patient. It has limited sensitivity for diagnosing pleural mesothelioma. Most studies reporting sensitivity below 60%. American Society of Clinical Oncology guidelines state that cytologic evaluation can serve as an initial screening test, but is not sufficiently sensitive as a definitive diagnostic test. Usually, immunohistochemistry for BAP1 and MTAP loss, along with FISH for homozygous CDKN2A deletion, can definitively support a diagnosis of epithelioid mesothelioma, specifically from cytology specimens, if available.
In the next segment, Drs. Desai, Dugogojack, and Ford discuss how to make a timely diagnosis of mesothelioma and the importance of multidisciplinary team involvement.
Dr. Dugogojack, any input specifically on what you are looking for on the scan or what you've seen commonly in terms of the presentations?
Yeah, I think perhaps the hardest one is if you just have a unilateral pleural effusion and you don't have a lot of pleural thickening, because then that could be consistent with various things. So I think perhaps more slam dunk as far as imaging would be having a unilateral pleural thickening without a parenchymal lung nodule, right? I think that distinction is key. And also the distribution of lymph nodes is also key when you're trying to distinguish lung cancer from pleural mesothelioma. Lung cancer, we think about hilar and mediastinal nodes, where that's less common in mesothelioma. You're more likely to see these chest wall types of nodes, right? Internal mammary that you've talked about. And I think those to me are the primary features. You can have a pleural effusion as well. But when I start seeing that pleural thickening in the right historical context, then my antenna is raised for mesothelioma.
When do you send patients? Do you see patients usually get thoracentesis, maybe a pleural biopsy, and then have more non-diagnostic features and end up with thoracoscopy? Or, you know, how do you approach that in these patients?
Yeah, I think, Akash, we frequently see that patients will have one, two, or even three diagnostic, or in some cases, therapeutic thoracentesis. And you may have, your cytology report may say things like atypical mesothelial proliferation, scanty abnormal cells, these sort of reports. And often I think the most helpful procedure can be a thoracoscopy, usually a video-assisted thoracoscopy. And it has the advantage of giving enough tissue. So usually the surgeon can visualize the pleura during that procedure and potentially to take samples of abnormal areas. And also in some cases, it can be therapeutic in terms of either pleurodesis in some cases, or also insertion of pleurics catheter for palliation, so a pleural effusion. So I think it's a situation, particularly where you suspect mesothelioma, I think it's useful usually to have a thoracoscopy. Just to mention very briefly, there can be very atypical presentations of mesothelioma. Very rarely we can see solid masses in single areas, even close to the mediastinum. So that's something just to keep in the back of your mind. But as Dr. Dugogojack mentioned, usually it's a pretty typical presentation.
And so when you're having the video-assisted thoracoscopy and biopsy, Dr. Dagoga Jack, if you can highlight some of the things you're looking for specifically on the pathology report or requests of testing that you want from your pathologist, and how does the typical workflow look like for you at your institution?
Yeah, so I think this is a rare diagnosis. So you want to have pathologists that have confidence and expertise in this diagnosis. So we often will see that if there's lack of clarity, they'll circulate it to colleagues at other institutions and other places just to get that buy-in and that consensus. But typically, as with any malignancy, you're looking at a panel of key kind of IHC or immunohistochemistry markers, and there's some and an ever-expanding number that have been associated with mesothelioma, right? So the typical ones, calretinin, WT1, and D240. But then you can also think about other semi-molecular ones that can help you a little bit when you don't have clarity, including BAP1 that we talked about. It's not in every single mesothelioma, but you can see it in the majority of them. And similarly, MTAP loss, not in every single mesothelioma, but you can see it as well. And so those are the types of things that we would prioritize. And I think one key point to make is the morphology matters too. So making sure you figure out what histotype or histologic type of the mesothelioma is present, epithelioid versus non-epithelioid, because as we'll talk about, that has implications for what to expect from treatment.
Do you have a workflow or, you know, things that your team does to ensure that we can shorten the time from diagnosis? Any specific things you found to be helpful?
I think perhaps the largest source of delay is actually those pleural effusions that people continuously kind of tap with the suspicion is not perhaps raised. So I think like education to our colleagues who encounter those effusions the most, right? Pulmonology colleagues, for our thoracic surgery colleagues, you do a tap if there's other features on the imaging that are highly suggestive of mesothelioma, getting the patient into multidisciplinary clinic as soon as possible. And I think maybe leapfrogging maybe that second or third tap and going straight for the pleural biopsy, especially if someone is symptomatic and their suspicion is quite high for mesothelioma.
And so when you have a patient that you see in your clinic, I imagine that, you know, the time to treatment for a patient with mesothelioma, where we talked about, you know, not much role outside of trials for a biomarker like PD-L1, I imagine you're sort of going into treatment potentially faster than, let's say, a lung cancer patient where you would wait for NGS results in most
cases. Exactly. I think once I have the diagnosis, I can, especially if you can get the surgeon to see them quickly, but I would actually say in our institution, we still do consider surgery, but in many cases, even if they're going for surgery, we do systemic therapy up front to learn a little bit about the biology of the disease. So once I have that diagnosis, I think the time between diagnosis and getting treatment is quite short. It's the time to make the diagnosis from the time of suspicion that is quite delayed.
In the next segment, Dr. Dagoga Jack discusses data for first-line treatment of advanced mesothelioma.
And so when we think about first-line treatment selection, we've already mentioned this, you have to think about the histology, as we'll get into histology matters in terms of the projected clinical outcomes of some of our treatments, the performance status, and so thinking about, as well as organ function for some of our therapies, right, and comorbidity. So do they have autoimmune diseases? Do they have creatinine clearance that would justify or support things like chemotherapy? And then there's symptom burden, right? That helps inform how aggressive we need to be and what types of efficacy endpoints that we might emphasize in a patient. And we'll go over those as we talk about a few trials. And so it used to be kind of historically that we were really stuck on platinum pemetrexed as far as our treatment option for mesothelioma. And that was based on a paper in 2003 by Dr. Vogelzang and colleagues. But fortunately, we're now in an era where we think about immunotherapy for virtually all comers with mesothelioma. And that's based on a handful of trials that we'll go over, starting with CheckMate 743. This was really a trial that led to the first new drug approval for mesothelioma in 16 years or so. And so this study took the historical standard of platinum pemetrexed and compared it to immunotherapy doublet. So nivolumab, PD-1 inhibitor, and ipilimumab, which is a CTLA-4 inhibitor. And so this wasn't like a blind type of comparison, meaning that this didn't come out of nowhere. There'd been phase two studies in patients who had pretreated mesothelioma, where there had been glimmers of activity justifying moving this up in a treatment naive setting. And so these are patients with unresectable pleural mesothelioma, treatment naive, who largely had good performance status. So performance status 0-1, typically what we see in clinical trials. And there was stratification according to histology, which was a great thing that they did, because as we look at the outcomes, there are some distinctions in terms of what to expect from each of these therapies according to histology. The primary endpoint was overall survival. And then there's other key secondary endpoints that are efficacy driven. We will spend some time talking about PD-L1 as well. And so these were the primary data that read out and they were presented that generated a lot of enthusiasm. So this is in the all-comer population, irrespective of histology. There was a four-month improvement in median overall survival from about 14 to 18 months. But I think it's important to take a deeper dive or a closer look according to histology. Remember, in mesothelioma, we think of epithelioid histology, which is 60+% of patients, and then non-epithelioid histology, which encompasses biphasic tumors and sarcomatoid tumors. And if we look at the performance of Nivo-Ipi in both of these populations, it actually performed comparably with the median overall survival around 18 months. But if you look at the second panel, so the non-epithelial tumors, and you look at that chemotherapy number, it is quite low, right? So 8 months, and this suggests that this group of patients with mesothelioma doesn't benefit that much from chemotherapy, and that really accentuates the benefit from Ipi-Nivo. If we focus on the first panel, so the first Kaplan-Meier curve, so epithelioid tumors, we see that perhaps it's not as pronounced, right? You go from 16.5 to 18.7 months. And in fact, if you really squint, the hazard ratio does cross one. But again, there are people benefiting from Ipi-Nivo here, but really, really, really accentuated in the non-epithelioid cohort. So how does PD-L1 inform what we do in terms of mesothelioma? We know that in non-small cell lung cancer, PD-L1 is a pretty robust biomarker that helps us select immunotherapy. I'll cut to the chase and say it's not as informative for selecting immunotherapy in mesothelioma. So if we look specifically at CheckMate 743, and this has really been replicated in other studies as well, and we look just at the Nivo-Ipi column for each of the for PD-L1 negative and PD-L1 positive, we see that the median overall survival is about 17 to 18 months. So really not that much of a decrement or an improvement in median overall survival depending on PD-L1 expression. But it might be that expressing PD-L1 is a negative predictive biomarker for chemotherapy, right? Then you drop to 13.3, and then you have, again, a more pronounced benefit with immunotherapy. So instead of kind of slamming our heads and trying to learn all of the numbers and the data, I think my conclusion here is that PD-L1 really doesn't distinguish who we should be selecting or moving or triaging towards immunotherapy. And I don't actually check it in my clinical practice as a result. And so to summarize CheckMate 743, the median overall survival in all comers improved by 4 months. And I think importantly, when we think about immunotherapy, we think about that tail, right? At the end of the curve, we want durable responses. And that manifests in looking at landmark overall survival. And so at 2 years, overall survival improved from 27% with chemotherapy to 41%. And again, just a key take home here is that the Ipi-Nivo was comparable in epithelioid and non-epithelioid, but the hazard ratio and the magnitude of benefit was greatest in non-epithelioid because chemotherapy performed so poorly and PD-L1 status is not really, it's not a key biomarker. I want you to remember one number from this data set, and that's the response rate. So the response rate to Nivo-Ipi and chemo is comparable, around 40%, but there's a longer duration of response with immunotherapy, which we've come to expect when we think about doublet immunotherapy. The reason I want you to remember that number is that when we talk about a different trial, it becomes important, as particularly when we're thinking about people with high symptom burden or bulky disease. And so looking at more long-term outcomes, the punchline of this slide is that at 3 years, less than 15% or less patients were alive with chemotherapy versus a quarter with Nivo-Ipi. And it's actually more pronounced when you look at the non-epithelioid cohort, where less than 5% of patients who receive chemotherapy are alive. And that number of a quarter of patients is sustained irrespective of histology. We know biology-wise, non-epithelioid is a more aggressive biology than epithelioid. So you're able to salvage some of that with immunotherapy. And then this is just, we know that immunotherapy, particularly doublet immunotherapy, sometimes gets invites additional scrutiny because of the toxicity profile and particularly the propensity towards immune-related adverse events. And this is just giving us confidence that if you discontinue doublet immunotherapy because of a toxicity, you can still have pretty sustained responses. So this is a cohort carved out of CheckMate 743. That actually benefited very much from this therapy. The response rate was 67%, but I think more impressively, they stopped treatment after around four months, and you see ongoing response in a third of patients at 3 years. So that's impressive and really speaking to the durability of immunotherapy effect for the subset of patients who benefit from this approach. And so I highlighted this in my last sentence. I talked about the subset of patients who benefit from this approach, because if we had squinted and looked at those Kaplan-Meier curves, we would have seen that in the epithelioid cohort and also in the non-epithelioid cohort, in that initial 3 months of treatment, there are some patients, the curves aren't, the Ipi-Nivo curve does not look uniformly above the chemotherapy curve. And that suggests that there are some patients who do not benefit from ipi-nivo or immunotherapy at all in that chemotherapy, sorry, in the epithelioid and non-epithelioid cohorts. But as a field right now, we're still struggling to find the biomarker to define those patients. And what we've learned from non-small cell lung cancer is sometimes doing both chemotherapy and immunotherapy can help salvage some of those early progressions. And this study that we're talking about here is akin to thinking about KEYNOTE-189 in the context of non-small cell lung cancer. This is the brainchild of the Canadian clinical trials group, IND-227 or KEYNOTE-483. And here what they did is they took patients with pleural mesothelioma who were previously untreated and randomized them to receive the historical standard of platinum pemetrexed or platinum pemetrexed plus the PD-1 inhibitor pembrolizumab. The primary endpoint here is overall survival. And so this study was positive as well, leading to regulatory approval of this combination, but I'd say kind of on face value, perhaps modestly positive, right? So the median overall survival in all comers improved by about a month from 16 to 17 months, but this was statistically significant. And when you look at long-term outcomes, so at the three-year landmark, there was an 8% improvement in median overall survival from around 17 to 25% of patients still being alive. If we look according to histologic type, which is important, and remember with ipi-nivo, there really was a pronounced benefit in the non-epithelioid cohort compared to chemotherapy. The same is still true, perhaps not as pronounced, again, acknowledging the limitations of cross-trial comparison. But if you look at the second panel here, this is the non-epithelioid cohort with chemotherapy compared to chemo plus pembro, you go from 8 to 12 months. So a little bit less than the 8 to 18, but we should not be doing these cross-trial comparisons. But nonetheless, there is a benefit from adding or incorporation of immunotherapy for these patients. And that is really pronounced when you look at three-year survival, right? 7% versus 23% of patients. And if you look at the epithelioid, so that's the first panel, perhaps not as pronounced, right? So 18 versus nearly 20 months. But still benefit here in these patients and a 6% improvement in the three-year landmark in the proportion of patients who are alive from this therapy. And so PD-L1, rather than kind of diving into the minutiae of this slide, I will just point out again that PD-L1 is not the most robust biomarker in the context of immunotherapy for mesothelioma. So frankly, I don't test it routinely in clinical practice, but I actually think it was great that it was included in these studies to give us that confidence about whether or not we need to test it, and also as an attempt to identify biomarkers to guide our clinical management. And so a summary of KEYNOTE-483, so again, about a 1 month improvement in median overall survival, which was statistically significant. And then in the non-epithelioid cohort, just to highlight a 4 month improvement in median overall survival, PD-L1. Yes, there are numbers here that I can point out that are numerically higher, but I would just point out that, and I invite kind of the input of my colleagues as well in the panel discussion, et cetera, but I don't necessarily do PD-L1 testing. I think the one point I wanted to truly highlight with this particular clinical trial was if we recall that 40% number that I talked about for objective response rate with chemotherapy, so platinum doublet chemo and ipi-nivo, it actually improves if you do platinum pemetrexed plus pembrolizumab. Here you go to 62%. And so when I think about a patient with a high disease burden or quite symptomatic disease, that might be one advantage of this regimen. There is more toxicity associated with it, and these are mostly immune-related toxicities that we've become accustomed to navigating the thoracic disease space with non-small cell lung cancer and similar diseases. And just the final trial I wanted to discuss is actually somewhat historical in that it predates the immunotherapy era. Then this is a study that is the MAP study by Professor Zalkman and colleagues. And what it did was take the same population that we've been talking about, right? So pleural mesothelioma, good performance status, treatment naive, and randomized patients to receive platinum pemetrexed or platinum pemetrexed plus the angiogenesis inhibitor bevacizumab. Those who received bevacizumab had maintenance with bevacizumab. And the primary endpoints are survival endpoints, right? PFS and overall survival. And here we see that there is an improvement in both PFS and overall survival. And I just want to highlight the overall survival curve just for 2 points. The first is that with the addition of bevacizumab, you reach that median overall survival of around 18 months, which is what we saw with in our two trials with incorporation of ipi-nivo. So it does seem that this may be lengthening the duration of survival for some patients. I do also want to point out that the robust performance of the control arm in this study, so 16 months, which is a little bit higher than what we saw with some of our other trials here. But I think the space for doing this particular regimen is a little bit debatable now that we have immunotherapy uh, for for mesothelioma, but still something, the trial to be aware of in this space.
In the next segment, Doctors Desai, Dugogojack, and Ford discuss how they select frontline treatment for their patients with mesothelioma.
One of the questions that we got from the audience is, who do you treat with IO versus IO versus IO chemo, which is kind of the first question that we had anyways to discuss. And I guess just kind of following up on what you mentioned, I think, you know, my practice also is histology dependent, and what you discussed in terms of non-epithelioid, you know, using nivolumab, ipilimumab based on the CheckMate 743. And I think there is definitely a role for chemotherapy in epithelioid. So before, you know, the carbopemetrexed pembrolizumab was approved, I was using more of chemotherapy compared to the dual checkpoint inhibitor approach in the epithelioid histology. And now, obviously, with the Keynote approval, I am using more of the carbopemetrexed and pembrolizumab as well. So I think my practice, you know, sort of reflects what you mentioned and what the poll suggested. But curious to see what Dr. Ford has to add. And is there anything in particular that you look outside of these things? Do you use PD-L1 or even test for it, as Dr. Dugogojack was discussing?
Yeah, I think so. I think the PD-L1, I very much agree with Dr. Dugogojack on that point. I don't think it's necessarily a useful biomarker here. And I think the histology is probably a key differentiator. I think a patient with non-epithelioid disease needs to have immunotherapy at some point, and ideally at the earliest time point possible. So I tend to favor actually combination immune checkpoint there for those patients. So ipilimumab, nivolumab, I think that's where the data is strongest. Interestingly enough, in Europe, the European Medicines Agency only approved the platinum pemetrexed pembrolizumab for non-epithelioid disease based on their review of the data. So it's an interesting subtext to the assessment of the trials. For epithelioid tumors, I again will probably overall favor dual checkpoint. I think that was a strong trial. It is patient dependent. I think if patients are very symptomatic from their disease, or if they have a very high burden of disease, I do think you see responses a little bit faster with chemoimmunotherapy. So sometimes I will use that as a metric for those patients with epithelioid disease. But a patient who's minimally symptomatic, low burden of disease, I think it can be useful to consider combination immune checkpoint. And then there's, I don't think we're going to go into this in too much detail today, but there is the question of surgery as well for earlier stage disease, which is still kind of on the radar, despite some negative studies in that regard.
That's absolutely right. And so I guess one question for Dr. Dugogojack, I know you kind of mentioned symptom burden as, you know, potentially an important factor in deciding treatment. Do you have scenarios where you would use chemotherapy in non-epithelioid based on thinking about the symptom burden? What is their patient selection criteria for perhaps that situation?
Meaning chemo by itself or chemo IO?
Yeah, I mean chemo IO.
Yeah, I think sometimes you're faced with these situations where you feel like you have, for lack of a better word, one of my colleagues says often, one shot on goal, right? You have to get it right. And I think in those instances, very high burden disease, sometimes patients who I see who come to me with de novo metastatic, right, where they already have peritoneal and other disease, then I might think about it. Or someone for whom I'm a little wary of dual IO, right? Someone who has maybe some baseline arthritis or arthralgia and other things where I think they can tolerate single agent IO. And sometimes the pemetrexed actually helps with some of that, and the steroids that we give with the treatment is someone I might think about. I do want to say that there are very, very rare instances where I do think about platinum pemetrexed by itself for epithelioid mesothelioma. And I think for patients who have very, very low burden disease, some of my elderly patients with preserved kidney function who say they don't want immunotherapy or they don't want to be on treatment for 2 years, there is some advantage to a self-limited course of treatment in those patients when we talk about immunotherapy. And for those for whom immunotherapy is absolutely contraindicated, right? I would be less enthusiastic about that type of option in non-epithelioid though. So here I'm talking about epithelioid solely. But my default, as Dr. Ford and you have mentioned, is really IO-IO. For non-epithelioid unless I talk myself out of it for some reason.
I'm just going to mention one thing, Akash, as well. There are some patients, particularly older patients, who have very indolent disease, which sometimes observation can be an option as well. And that's something I often discuss with patients. If they're completely asymptomatic, something is picked up kind of incidentally, it's not unreasonable to monitor it for a few months and see, keep a close watch on things before embarking on therapy.
In the next segment, Dr. Ford discusses the Evolve Meso and Atomic trials.
There is an ongoing phase 3 trial at the moment, and that's Evolve Meso, and this study is active globally. And this is looking at a novel agent, volrustomig, which is a bispecific antibody with two arms, one targeting PD-1 and the other one targeting CTLA-4. So essentially combining the equivalent of two agents like ipilimumab and nivolumab in one compound. And we've seen activity from bispecifics targeting other targets such as VEGF very recently. So this is a very interesting molecule. The trial at the moment is enrolling patients with newly diagnosed unresectable pleural mesothelioma. They're randomized to either a control arm of either ipilimumab nivolumab or platinum pemetrexed chemotherapy for epithelioid disease. And for the non-epithelioid population, they're required to receive dual checkpoint blockade. And the investigational arm is essentially combining the two most effective therapies and more treatment approaches, including chemotherapy plus PD-1 plus CTLA-4, with a primary event, a primary endpoint of overall survival in the epithelioid population. So that study is ongoing. We don't yet have results. There have been other successes, and the Atomic Meso trial looked at an interesting compound, PEG arginase. This is an agent essentially which targets loss of ASS1. This renders mesothelioma cells unable internally to synthesize arginine, and they depend on external supplies of arginine. So if you deplete arginine using this molecule, it potentially can lead to these cancer cells dying. And this is enhanced in biphasic or sarcomatoid mesothelioma. Hence, this study enrolled that patient population and randomized patients to either chemotherapy plus placebo in the control arm or chemo plus the novel compound in the investigational arm. And those patients in the investigational arm continued on maintenance, so adding PEG 20 or placebo. And this study also was affected by the approval of ipilimumab nivolumab and closed early. However, it was a positive trial. And this compound is currently under review by the FDA with consideration for approval in this population. We'll see the results here. So again, there was a significant improvement in progression-free survival and also a significant improvement in overall survival from the addition of adipeg to standard chemotherapy. Now, we've spoken earlier that the preferred therapy at the moment for these patients is probably dual checkpoint blockade. So if and when this new regimen became available, how we might incorporate it into the treatment landscape is going to be interesting. Would there be a paradigm where patients receive dual checkpoint blockade up front and then perhaps chemotherapy plus this compound as a second line approach? However, I think it's going to be individualized. So in general, for mesothelioma, even though we've made a lot of progress in recent years, we need to continue making progress. So I think clinical trials are really essential for eligible patients in this setting, including in the first line.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. For more information on this topic, click on the link in the podcast description.